Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Parliament began the week with the Speaker, David Carter, welcoming fellow MPs from around the Pacific.
Honourable members, I'm sure that members would wish to welcome parliamentarians from Fiji, Niue, Samoa, Tonga and Tuvalu who are present in the gallery.
Mr. Carter then acknowledged a call from Labour's Phil Twyford.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to move a motion without notice or debate on the death of British Member of Parliament, Joe Cox.
Our leave is sought for that course of action. Is there any objection? There is none. Phil Twyford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that this House express its sympathy for the family, friends and colleagues of British Member of Parliament, Joe Cox, who was attacked and killed as she went about her duties as a local Member of Parliament on 17th of June, and pass condolences and solidarity to the British Parliament. Joe Cox was a friend of mine and a colleague. She was the best of what we all want elected representatives to be.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Those of that opinion will say aye.
Aye.
To the contrary, no. The ayes have it. The motion is agreed to.
Then it was on to question time with the first question of the day coming from Greens co-leader Andrew Shaw.
My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by all his statements?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, yes.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Why then did he tell me in April that foreign trust disclosure requirements on registration were, quote, broad and deep, when John Shewan described them this morning on national radio as, quote, absolutely minimal and tells nobody anything, end quote?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, because I believe that to be an accurate reflection. If you look at what Mr Shewan's actually saying, it's not the amount of information that's being collected, it's where it's actually placed, and he believes that should be more fully in the hands of IRD as opposed to the trustees. But broadly speaking, he's not recommending significant changes in the amount of information that's collected.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. When he said that our disclosure requirements were, quote, broad and deep, why then did the Shewan inquiry find that foreign trust disclosure rules are, quote, inadequate, not fit for purpose, and therefore likely to be abused?
Mr Speaker,
as I said, I mean, if you look at what Mr Shewan was also saying on national radio this morning, he was saying that essentially the issue here is where that information is kept, not what is collected, and made the point that he thought that should be at the level of IRD with a register that can be searched by relevant agencies. The government agrees with that and will continue to do that.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Given that John Shewan has suggested that dodgy foreign trusts will quietly withdraw under the new disclosure rules, will the PM ask the Minister of Revenue to ensure that those trusts are investigated?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, they're not the words Mr Shewan used.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
When Todd McClay told the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee last year that none of the reports that he had received from Inland Revenue drew any conclusion on foreign trusts, did he mislead the Select Committee?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
No.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
When Revenue Minister Michael Woodhouse ruled out making any changes to foreign trust rules in April, saying that they were world class, did he just get it wrong?
Right Honourable Prime Minister.
No. In fact, actually, as John Shewan pointed out in the report, New Zealand's international reputation, rightfully so, is very strong. What he has recommended is a few changes that, in light of the Panama Papers and the international focus on not New Zealand but the broader issue, it's appropriate for New Zealand to make some changes. The government will follow those.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. When the Prime Minister insists that our foreign trusts have full disclosure despite warnings to the contrary from first Inland Revenue in 2012 and now John Shewan, is he not misleading the public and this House?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, no, and I refer the member to John Shewan's interview on Morning Report this morning, where he made it quite clear there is full disclosure.
Question number two, Andrew Little.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his statement that, quotes, tax havens where there is non-disclosure of information, New Zealand has full disclosure of information, end quotes, given the Shewin report, quotes, concludes that the existing foreign trust disclosure rules are inadequate, end quotes, and, quotes, not fit for purpose in the context of preserving New Zealand's reputation?
What? Speaker.
Right Honourable
Speaker, yes, I note that Mr. Shewin this morning confirmed that New Zealand does currently have full disclosure of information. As he explained, records are required to be maintained by trusts, and if they're asked to exchange that information, they must do so. Mr. Shewin has recommended extra measures that will see that information provided to IRD through a searchable register.
Supplementary.
Order. Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Does he agree with the Shewin report that, quotes, there is a reasonable likelihood that the regime is facilitating the hiding of funds or evasion of tax? And if so, why has he consistently denied there's a problem?
The Right Honourable
Mr. Speaker, I can't confirm that one way or the other because I don't have any access to the source document, and Mr. Shewin himself was unable to find any evidence that that was the case.
Supplementary.
Andrew Little, supplementary question.
Does he agree with the Shewin report that, quotes, under current law and enforcement practices, the risk of detection by authorities is low, end quotes, and if so, why has he consistently claimed there is no problem?
Mr. Speaker.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
I certainly agree with Mr. Shewin that there can be improvements because by having that information at IRD's level in the searchable register, it makes it easier. But New Zealand has complied with every request it's had. The same information will still be collected, and in fact under the changes the government's made, including the extension of the automatic exchange of information, the rules around FACTA and others, has seen that actually New Zealand does, by the way, have that information and it does give full disclosure.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question. Order.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Order, Tim McIntyre.
What does the independent Shewin report have to say about claims that New Zealand is a tax haven?
The Speaker. Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it concludes that such claims are wide of the mark. The report says, and I quote, the tax treatment of foreign trusts follows New Zealand's long-established and principled policy of not imposing tax, New Zealand tax on foreign source income derived by non-residents. The report goes on, and I quote, to say it does not result in New Zealand being a tax haven under established OECD criteria.
Supplementary.
Caught out.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Does he agree with the Shewin report that, quotes, New Zealand is part of a global tax police force to clamp down on aggressive tax practices, end quote, and if so, why has he allowed New Zealand trusts to dodge other countries' tax?
Well, Mr. Speaker,
right on
New Zealand's primary purpose from an IRD perspective is to preserve our own tax base. Of course, it's also to have good international tax practice, and we do. As the Shewin report quite correctly says, New Zealand ranks right at the top for best international tax practice.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Which is true? His claim that we provide full information to other governments, or the Shewin report's finding that, quote, the paucity of information currently disclosed appears to limit IRD's ability to proactively provide assistance to foreign revenue authorities.
Well, Mr. Speaker,
Right Honourable Prime
Minister. The member is selectively trying to quote from John Shewin when this morning he made it quite clear on Morning Report that, in fact, actually, the situation is that New Zealand does have full disclosure. Mr. Shewin is not recommending a significant widening of the amount of information collected. What he is recommending is that there should be a searchable register held at IRD's level.
Supplementary question.
Oh. Supplementary question. Order. Tim McIndoe. Order.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What reports has the Prime Minister seen on the appointment of Mr. Shewin to lead the independent inquiry into foreign trust disclosure rules?
Speaker.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've seen several reports. The first was a joint statement from the Finance Minister and Revenue Minister describing Mr. Shewin as a highly regarded tax expert. Mr. Speaker, a second report claimed Mr. Shewin had advised the Bahamas on how to preserve its status as a tax haven. Mr. Speaker, This led to a third report, interestingly enough, actually released 2 hours before an All Black test match, where the same source admitted he was completely wrong.
Order, I thank the Prime Minister, but I don't see any ministerial responsibility. Order. I want substantially less interjection from members to my right. Andrew Little.
Supplementary, Mr. Speaker. If at least one member of the House is capable of accepting when he has got it wrong and publicly acknowledging that, when is he going to acknowledge to the public of New Zealand that he misled them about the state of our foreign trust tax laws?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I haven't not misled the New Zealand public. We've certainly commissioned a report and made sure that that report comes up with some recommendations. But, Mr. Speaker, if I had misled the New Zealand public, I wouldn't hide behind the liniment bottles and try and release that apology 2 hours before an All Black test match and pretend no one saw it. I'd have the courage of my conviction.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why did he block efforts to fix foreign trusts in 2013 when the Shewin report finds they help tax evasion, that the risk of getting caught is low, and we don't give enough assistance to countries trying to stop tax dodgers?
Right Honourable Prime Minister. Answer the first part of the question, the member's incorrect. In the second part of the question, the Shewin report makes it quite clear that New Zealand has a very high international reputation. In fact, says the only damage done is by misguided New Zealand politicians trying to score domestic political points. And in fact, internationally, there was virtually no coverage of New Zealand because it is well respected for what it does.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Isn't it time for him to stop playing silly buggers and admit what the IRD told him in 2013, what John Shewin told him last week, and what every New Zealander knows, that his government has been harbouring foreign tax dodgers for far too long?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the member, if he wants to look at responsibility, should get out a mirror and stop apologising to John Shewin 2 hours before an All Black test match and have the guts to get up and say it in this parliament that he's sorry.
Order.
Question time ended with this announcement from the Speaker.
I've received a letter from Andrew Little seeking to debate Understanding Order 389, the release of the report on the government inquiry into foreign trust disclosure rules. The release of the report is a particular case of recent occurrence for which there is ministerial responsibility. The subject of the report is a significant one, and the government has stated it will implement most of its recommendations. It is not clear, however, from the government's response which recommendations it will implement and whether it will involve changes to legislation. Therefore, this may be the only occasion for the House to debate this issue. The matter has attracted significant media and public attention in the past few months, raising potential risks to preserving New Zealand's reputation. Having carefully considered this application, I believe it does require the urgent attention of the House. I therefore call on Andrew Little to move that the House take note of an urgent matter of public importance. Andrew Little.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, John Key and the National Government have had to be dragged kicking and screaming to do anything about the dodgy foreign trusts regime that they have set up and to ensure that at last New Zealand gets to preserve, or at least try and restore, its international reputation in tax matters.
Back now to last week when there were just a couple of select committees. Rhys Lyon reports.
Select Committee scrutiny of the government's budget takes place each year soon after Budget Day, with areas of spending, known as votes, divided up by the Finance and Expenditure Committee and sent off to the relevant committees to look at in detail. The hearings are conducted in public and feature ministers fronting up to defend their ministries' spending plans. With Parliament adjourned for the week, only one such meeting was held, with the Commerce Committee taking 45 minutes on Monday afternoon to review this year's budget allocation for Vote Tourism. The Minister for Tourism is the Prime Minister, John Key, but he's usually running his Cabinet meeting on a Monday afternoon, followed by a post-Cabinet press conference. And so the job of explaining this year's budget funding for Mr. Key's portfolio of tourism fell to his Associate Minister, Paula Bennett, who outlined some industry statistics, including an 11% increase in visitor arrivals to New Zealand in the first 4 months of the year.
You know, to give you an idea, that 11% means an increase of 312,500 people. 312,500 actual people is that kind of increase that we're talking about of 11%. The biggest increase is by country of residence, so China up 88,100, so that's the growth there. Australia, very close, second at 87,100, and the United States up 24,400. So holidaymakers made up just over half the visitors who arrived in April, and friends and relatives, visits to friends and relatives was second. So we're just seeing a huge, huge uptake there. As you could see, that $10 billion international visitors spending, and we've got a huge market in that domestic markets going up as well, which is quite exciting because they often go to different parts of the country.
When it came to questions to the Associate Tourism Minister from Commerce Committee members, Labour's Chris Farfoy pointed to statistics suggesting a 36,000-person workforce shortage in the tourism industry and asked what the government was doing to address that.
So it is still the latest number that we've got is 36,000. Additional full-time equivalent workers will need to be directly employed in the tourism sector, but that's, as I say, directly employed and not taking in those other businesses that support the tourism sector as such. So we've got a whole suite of kind of activities that are going on between the Tourism Industry Association, the government led itself, and it is going to have to be supplemented though by an overseas workforce that are here on work visas. So I don't know the number on that, and I don't think we've got one. But what I would say to you is that every tourism operator or employer you speak to would rather be employing a New Zealander.
Paula Bennett was also asked about an apparent shortage of accommodation in Queenstown.
So worker accommodation is certainly an issue for Queenstown, let alone kind of house prices and everything else. So we have been, I was there just a few weeks ago and was discussing it with them. There's a range of views from that government should be building all the houses for the workers and paying for them all. I sort of felt like the rest of New Zealand has probably got more pressing issues at the moment. To be really honest with you, with the bit of the housing hat on as well that you can't help having, I did say to the business chamber down there that I felt that they were the best resourced and the best and the most and some of our most intelligent people in the country, and they could sort their problem out without huge government. It wouldn't be where the government would be choosing to invest housing money right now, to be quite blunt.
There are also questions from the government side of the committee table, including one from National's Kanwaljit Singh Bakshi, about how the tourism industry was targeting and catering to visitors from India. Sitting alongside the Associate Minister with details to hand on the Indian market was Tourism New Zealand Chief Executive Kevin Bowler.
We're really pleased with the performance from India. We're, in the last 5 years, the market's doubled in size. We're nearly 50,000 visitors now. Our principal focus is on Mumbai, and we are increasingly looking at Delhi as an opportunity for extending our marketing reach. A lot of our activity is done through digital marketing. It's aimed at upper-income professionals in those large metropolitan cities and capitalises on the fact that those visitors prefer to come to New Zealand in our spring and our autumn periods, which fits our profile perfectly for when we want to see increased visitation. The other good thing about India, which is continues to play out really strongly for us, is the Indian visitors participate in a lot of activities and they're quite high spenders while they're in New Zealand. So our program is focused on a range of different demographics, from professionals as well as families, And we've had good success, particularly leveraging celebrities in India as one way of getting a lot of impact in that market.
Mr. Singh Bakshi also asked if there were any plans for direct flights between New Zealand and India.
I don't think there's any likelihood in the short term that we'll be fortunate enough to get a direct air service. But I do think in the medium term there is that prospect. What we are seeing, though, is a strengthening of air connectivity in terms of one-stop connections. So one-stop connections through Dubai, one-stop connections through Bangkok, through Malaysia and through Singapore. So we're seeing a lot of that expansion and capacity on the basis that, yes, you'll need to do one stop to get to New Zealand. So that's from our perspective, promising, and it's not putting a blockage on the demand that we were experiencing, say, 2 or 3 years ago, where air capacity was a really big issue.
And in response to questions stemming from Paula Bennett's earlier statements about growing Chinese tourism, the Associate Minister suggested the industry shouldn't over-cater to that market.
Because what I often say to them is to make sure that we still give them a New Zealand experience. That we actually don't, you know, we sort of don't get so caught in trying to make them feel so comfortable that actually, you know, they haven't left their own country. They've come to New Zealand for a New Zealand experience, and we should ensure that we're actually giving them all of that. But that doesn't mean that we have to worry, that we need to lower our expectations on quality. But, yeah, we don't want to turn into a kind of our hotels all looking the same and everyone sort of getting the same experience that they might anywhere else in the world.
Also appearing alongside Paula Bennett was Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment Tourism Manager Lisa Barrett, who said MB had been doing some China market research,
which has done quite an extensive look at the qualitative and quantitative information around what Chinese people want when they come to New Zealand. What we've done is we've taken that research and we've actually been disseminating it through a series of workshops throughout New Zealand. We've had both tourism operators, along with people from the regional tourism organisations and anyone who wants to participate, really, to come along and hear what the key findings are. It's been really well received from what we've heard. And it's some interesting stuff coming through around sort of changing demographic of that group. We're seeing more family groups coming. They're actually wanting to come and repeat their visit to New Zealand again. Also a bit more interest in adventure activities and that kind of stuff, which is interesting, and it's a change from what we've seen before.
And Paula Bennett had a theory on that.
A big part of it is with the one-child policy for so long that there was actually some concern that those children are getting a little bit mollycoddled, and so they bring to New Zealand and they literally want them to have more of the adventure activities. One operator was saying they've got more Chinese visitors that are kind of doing the 1 or 2 nights camping because they want their children to really experience the great outdoors and not think that it's all flash hotels and good restaurants, that actually there's an outdoor element to it as well.
Associate Tourism Minister Paula Bennett speaking to the Commerce Committee during its review of this year's budget allocation for Vote Tourism.
That report from Rhys Lyon. On Wednesday, the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee met in the Gene Batten Room at Auckland Airport's Holiday Inn to continue hearing submissions on its inquiry into the future of New Zealand's mobility. One of those submissions came from representatives of ride-sharing app Uber, led by its public policy associate Ben Brooks.
What we're here to talk about is ride-sharing, and ride-sharing has become the accepted nomenclature for basically just the use of your existing personal vehicle to provide some rides. Uber is a technology company that facilitates ride-sharing in probably close to 500 cities worldwide now through its app platform. So essentially the way it works is a rider, a member of the public, will register their payment details, their credit card, PayPal account through the app, including their contact details. The app will connect them to a registered driver partner, and it will direct that driver to pick up the person, conduct the trip. The app provides in-trip navigation advice, and then at the end of the trip, the app will facilitate a cashless and automatic transaction. So that's essentially how the model works.
Ben Brooks outlined how ride-sharing was contributing to existing urban transport networks.
We see ourselves as supplementing public transport. So I think we flagged in that submission, and we've confirmed it subsequently as well, that about half our trips, or just under half of the trips that we conduct in Auckland and Wellington, are what we would describe as being to or from a public transport desert. So these are areas that are more than 800 metres away from a medium-frequency transport node. And many of those trips are to or from transport nodes themselves, so to or from the rail station.
Mr. Brooks said that rather than impinging on what he called the, quote, incumbent point-to-point industry, otherwise known as taxis, ride-sharing was servicing an entirely new market.
Very much servicing consumers who would not otherwise take a taxi to get from A to B. The majority of trips in Sydney, for instance, are people who would not otherwise take a taxi to conduct the equivalent journey. The New South Wales Economic Regulator, just last week, I think it was, released some data that shows that since ride-sharing first entered the market, and since the government regulated ride-sharing, taxi demand has increased progressively over that period.
And while Uber was scheduled to be the last submission of the day, that slot ended up going to latecomer David Wilmot, the co-director for the Centre for Urban and Transport Studies.
Firstly, my apologies for taking an hour and 20 minutes to get here instead of the hour I allowed on the presumption that it should and would take me 50 minutes when it should take 40 minutes. That is the state of Auckland Transport today.
David Wilmot speculated on the cause of that situation.
Auckland Transport is in the business of being told to promote public transport by usurping multi-purpose road lanes for single-purpose bus use, for example, where the space between those buses can accommodate 300 cars. The Northern Busway, for example, if you stand on an overbridge and look both ways in the peak hour, you will see a bus about five-minute intervals. Alongside that, you'll see a congested motorway.
Mr. Wilmot wasn't confident about finding a solution to Auckland's transport issues.
I don't expect this government, given its past record, or any other government, given their past records, to grapple with this problem effectively. This committee is wasting its time if it thinks it merely needs to legislate for change and that change will occur, if it merely thinks its job is to predict future technology and then to provide for that technology alone, because the history of the world shows that the future is unknown and can take a whole variety of courses.
Co-director for the Centre for Urban and Transport Studies, David Wilmot. Another submission came from the Blind Foundation's Neil Jarvis.
Disabled people are frequently described as isolated. And it isn't just because they can't get out of the house because there are steps at the house or something like that. That might be the case. But the real reason is that the access to transport and other environmental systems which require vision, hearing or physical mobility is at best restricted and often downright impossible. If I take myself, for example, I can't read signs. So if there's a really critical bit of information being conveyed by a visual sign, it ain't being conveyed to me. So I'm going to miss that, and that might be quite important. We don't know when a bus is approaching. Well, we know when a bus is approaching, but we don't necessarily know if it's the right bus. Have you ever got on the wrong bus? It's quite fun, I can tell you. I've done it many times. And not only have I done that, got on the wrong bus, I've often got off at the wrong stop, even if it was the right bus. I mean, that's just unfair.
The Blind Foundation's Neil Jarvis with that submission to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee's inquiry into the future of New Zealand's mobility. I'm Tom Frewen, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.